Penguin Random House Audio presents Science in the Soul, Selected Writings of a Passionate Rationalist by Richard Dawkins, edited by Gillian Summerscales. Read by Richard Dawkins,
Lala Ward, and Gillian Summerscales.
In memory of Christopher Hitchens. Author's Introduction. I am writing this 2 days after a breathtaking visit to Arizona's Grand Canyon. Breathtaking still hasn't gone the way of awesome, although I fear it may. To many Native American tribes, the Grand Canyon is a sacred place, site of numerous origin myths from the Havasupai to the Zuni, hushed repose of the Hopi dead. If I were forced to choose a religion, that's the kind of religion I could go for. The Grand Canyon confers stature on a religion, outclassing the petty smallness of the Abrahamics, the three squabbling cults which, through historical accident, still afflict the world. In the dark night, I walked out along the south rim of the canyon, lay down on a low wall and gazed up at the Milky Way. I was looking back in time, witnessing a scene from 100,000 years ago, for that is when the light set out on its long quest to dive through my pupils and spark my retinas. At dawn the following morning, I returned to the spot, shuddered with vertigo as I realized where I had been lying in the dark, and looked down towards the canyon's floor. Again, I was gazing into the past, 2 billion years in this case, back to a time when only microbes stirred sightless beneath the Milky Way. If Hopi souls were sleeping in that majestic hush, they were joined by the rock-bound ghosts of trilobites and crinoids, brachiopods and belemnites, ammonites, even dinosaurs. Was there some point in the mile-long evolutionary progression up the canyon strata when something you could call a soul sprang into existence, like a light suddenly switched on? Or did the soul creep stealthily into the world, a dim thousandth of a soul in a pulsating tube worm, a tenth of a soul in a coelacanth, half a soul in a tarsier, then a typical human soul, eventually a soul on the scale of a Beethoven or a Mandela? Or is it just silly to speak of souls at all? Not silly if you mean something like an overwhelming sense of subjective personal identity. Each one of us knows we possess it, even if, as many modern thinkers aver, it is an illusion constructed, as Darwinians might speculate, because a coherent agency of singular purpose helps us to survive. Visual illusions such as the Necker cube or the Penrose impossible triangle or the hollow mask illusion demonstrate that the reality we see consists of constrained models constructed in the brain. The Necker cube's two-dimensional pattern of lines on paper is compatible with two alternative constructions of a three-dimensional cube, and the brain adopts the two models in turn. The alternation is palpable, and its frequency can even be measured. The Penrose triangle's lines on paper are incompatible with any real-world object. These illusions tease the brain's model construction software, thereby revealing its existence. In the same way, the brain constructs in software the useful illusion of personal identity, an I apparently residing just behind the eyes, an agent taking decisions by free will, a unitary personality seeking goals and feeling emotions. The construction of personhood takes place progressively in early childhood, perhaps by the joining up of previously disparate fragments. Some psychological disorders are interpreted as split personality, failure of the fragments to unite. It's a not unreasonable speculation that the progressive growth of consciousness in the infant mirrors a similar progression over the longer timescale of evolution. Does a fish, say, have a rudimentary feeling of conscious personhood on something like the same level as a human baby? We can speculate on the evolution of the soul, but only if we use the word to mean something like the constructed internal model of a self. Things are very different if by soul we mean a spook that survives bodily death. Personal identity is an emergent consequence of material brain activity, and it must disintegrate, eventually reverting to its pre-birth nothingness when the brain decays. But there are poetic usages of soul and related words that I am unashamed to embrace. In an essay published in my earlier anthology, A Devil's Chaplain, I deployed such words to extol a great teacher, F. W. Sanderson, headmaster of my old school before I was born. Notwithstanding the ever-present risk of misunderstanding, I wrote of the spirit and the ghost of the dead Sanderson.
His spirit lived on at Arundel. His immediate successor, Kenneth Fisher, was chairing a staff meeting when there was a timid knock on the door and a small boy came in.
"Please, sir, there are black terns down by the river."
"This can wait," said Fisher decisively to the assembled committee. He rose from the chair, seized his binoculars from the door, and cycled off in the company of the small ornithologist and, one can't help imagining, with the benign, ruddy-faced ghost of Sanderson beaming in their wake.
I went on to refer to the shade of Sanderson after describing another scene from my own education when an inspiring science teacher, Johan Thomas, who came to the school because he admired Sanderson, although he was too young to have met him, dramatically taught us the value of admitting ignorance. He asked us one by one a question to which we all wildly guessed answers. Finally, our curiosity aroused, we clamoured, "Sir, sir," for the true answer. Mr. Thomas waited dramatically for silence, and then spoke slowly and distinctly, pausing for effect between each word. "I don't know. I don't know."
Again the fatherly shade of Sanderson chuckled in the corner, and none of us will have forgotten that lesson. What matters is not the facts, but how you discover and think about them. Education in the true sense, very different from today's assessment-mad exam culture.
Was there a risk that readers of my earlier essay might misunderstand that spirit of Sanderson, living on, his benign, ruddy-faced ghost beaming, or his shade chuckling in the corner? I don't think so, although God knows, there we go again, there's enough eager appetite for misunderstanding out there. I have to recognise that the same risk, born of the same eagerness, stalks this volume's title, Science in the Soul. What does it mean? Let me sidestep before attempting to answer. I think it's high time the Nobel Prize for Literature was awarded to a scientist. I'm sorry to say the nearest precedent is a very poor example, Henri Bergson, more of a mystic than a true scientist, whose vitalistic élan vital was lampooned in Julian Huxley's satirical railway train propelled by élan locomotif. But seriously, why not a real scientist for the Literature Prize? Although, alas, he is no longer with us to receive it, who would deny that Carl Sagan's writing is of Nobel literary quality, up there with the great novelists, historians, and poets? How about Lauren Isley, Lewis Thomas, Peter Medawar, Stephen Jay Gould, Jacob Bronowski, D'Arcy Thompson? Whatever the merits of individual authors whom we might name, isn't science itself a worthy subject for the best writers, more than capable of inspiring great literature? And whatever the qualities that make science so, those same qualities that make for great poetry and Nobel-winning novels, don't we have here a good approach to the meaning of soul? Spiritual is another word that could be used to describe Sagan-esque literary science. It is widely thought that physicists are more likely to self-identify as religious than biologists. There's even statistical evidence of this from the fellows of both the Royal Society of London and the US National Academy of Sciences. But experience suggests that if you probe these elite scientists further, you'll find that even the 10% who profess some kind of religiosity have, in most cases, no supernatural beliefs, no God, no creator, no aspiration to an afterlife. What they do have, and they'll say so if pressed, is a spiritual awareness. They may be fond of the hackneyed phrase awe and wonder, and who can blame them? They may quote, as I do in these pages, the Indian astrophysicist Subramanian Chandrasekhar, shuddering before the beautiful, or the American physicist John Archibald Wheeler.
Behind it all is surely an idea so simple, so beautiful, that when we grasp it...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?